So we're talking about learning-centered meetings and classes. Jan constantly reminds us, what's your purpose? What's your purpose? Is it to dump information, or is it to help people learn? It's easier to dump information, folks. But are people learning when we do that? Do you want to be the sage of the sage? I think, Mary, those are your words. Or do you really want people to learn? It's easy to be the sage on the stage. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm just talking. Dr. Jan Wirsbaum comes from Iowa State. A group of us worked together to put this together. Vince Davis is here, helped us on the administrative side. And Drew Lyon is Nebraska, Vince is at Wisconsin now. And our team from Iowa State, Steve Fales is here, Bart Littlewire, Kendall Lampe, department head there, Michael Thompson, Michael's here, and Mary Wiedenhoff is here. So we work together thinking that we want to share what we've been learning at Iowa State through Jan. So Dr. Wirsba is a senior lecturer in the Department of Natural Resources and Ecology and Management. She's the leader of special projects for Project LEARN, LEA/RN. She has a background as a high school science teacher and comes to us with what I think you'll say is, we can all say is a non-traditional symposium. It's going to be very interactive. We'll be here till noon. If you have to come and go, then we understand that. But we needed a block of time to really get some of these concepts across. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I have and learned as much as I will today. So, Jan?
Thank you, Roger. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and it's also one of my greatest fears. I have a passion for helping others learn. I have the wonderful opportunity at Iowa State to work with both undergraduate and graduate education, and I also have the opportunity to work with them. What is learning? It happens only in the mind of the individual. And so our challenge is to engage the brain of the individual learner. In order to help you learn anything today, that's my challenge, to engage you in this session. So as Roger said, it's going to be very different, possibly, than what I'm used to. One of my major learning outcomes for today, my major purpose, is to help us all confront our beliefs about teaching and learning. As we do that, my hope is that we will uncover what we already know about human learning and be able to be more intentional about that information as we plan the learning for others. In the workshops I do with faculty, also in my classes, it's important for me that there's a lot of interaction and discussion during class. So I'm going to do that same thing here today. I was also going to say, I'm going to ask you to put on and take off different hats today. The hat of the learner and the hat of the person who is planning and facilitating the learning. And I'll try to help you with that because it's a bit confusing. In other words, I'm going to ask you to experience and to engage in a few strategies we found very effective for engaging the mind of the learner. After you have experienced that strategy, then I'll stop and talk about the impact it has for you as you plan learning of those attending work. One of the things that I use with nearly every meeting, every class I facilitate, is a go-around. A go-around is an opportunity for everyone in the learning session to say something without anybody challenging it. So we are going to start with go-around this morning. And for the go-around, rules are pretty simple. I'm going to either ask you a question or ask you to respond to something. And then we'll start with whoever volunteers. Typically, they decide if we go right or left. Usually, my sessions are set up so there's a big circle and everybody sees everyone else. We'll have to be a little flexible at that this morning. But the person The volunteers go first, determine whether we go right or left. That gives a little bit of warning to the person next to them. If, when it's your turn, you're not ready to respond, you pass. For students in a classroom, I think that's really important. We'll talk a bit more about that later. If you do pass, we'll come back to you, if I remember. Usually somebody helps me. Here's the open go around for this morning. I'd like to know your name, the institution that you're associated with. Very briefly, tell me how you are charged with helping others learn. For example, teaching undergraduate courses, planning extension meetings, working with faculty or faculty development. And tell me something that you learned recently or something that you are very good at doing. Neither has to be real profound.
You see the light?
Thank you. That was a comment to Jan T. earlier. I said, you know, here we are talking about learning. One thing we know is not good when you dim the light and turn on the PowerPoint. Because that gives people permission to go to sleep. So I appreciate the light. Anyway, back to something that you learned recently or something you heard that is doing. Recently, I've learned more than I've ever wanted to know about how to put up a steel shed on a paper. And I'm very good at asking questions. So back to our goal. Name, institution, very briefly, how you have to help people learn, and something you've learned recently or something you've learned good at doing. Anybody volunteer to start the go-around course? Thank you. Then we're just going to go around this table and then around each table.
Vernon Cardwell, Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, University of Minnesota, where I'm primarily involved in undergraduate teaching. And what I've learned is through a course that's called By the Harvest You Live, which is an honors course for freshmen, and it's half classroom and half field, and the students start by hand-stripping grain, using a scythe, tying by hand, threshing without a thresher, and moving through the 1800s into a thresh machine, and then going to a farm and looking at the largest combine that John Deere makes.
You want to go right?
I'm right.
Gilton Wittersma, University of Minnesota Extension. Extension educator in droughts, responsible for wheat, barley, and oats. Things learned. Beating a GPS system into submission for something it wasn't supposed to do. Good end. Seeing different pieces of information, tying it together.
And just to clarify, you don't have to tell us both what you're good at, what you learned recently, with either one or the other. Either way.
Craig Rosenbaum, Kansas State University Extension and Row Crops. And that's my role in teaching, and I haven't learned much lately. I'm kind of thick-headed.
We'll see if we can change that. That'll be one of my challenges. Thank you.
Vince Davis, University of Wisconsin at Madison. I'm a wheat scientist for corn, soybean, small greens, and sweet corn. I have a primary extension role for education across the state, as well as a staff there training coordinator. And I've recently been learning about greenhouse gas emission more than I wanted to.
Thanks.
I'm Bruce Erickson. I'm the agronomic education manager for the American Society of Agronomy. I'm also at Purdue University in Indiana. And I work a lot with the Certified Crop Advisor Program. And so I do a lot of online education, and I guess what I've learned is that I can violate a lot of the rules of traditional education online, and people still learn a lot and like what I'm doing.
John Turley from Thompson Rivers University. I'm an undergraduate student. I do some supplemental learning instruction. And recently I've been doing some other things.
Thanks.
My name is Kevin Watson. I'm from Thompson Rivers University in Hamilton, British Columbia, Canada. And I teach soil science, geographic information systems, and forest measurements in the graduate ESIC. What I've recently learned is that ArcMap GIS 10 is a big program, and I teach it, and I've had to write lab manuals, so that was my summer work in that program.
I'm Les Everett, University of Minnesota, the Water Resources Center. I put together grant-based projects on conservation and water. What I've learned more recently is more about digital elevation data.
I'm Michael Thompson, Iowa State. I'm primarily a soil chemist and mineralogist, and I've taught courses in those areas. Recently, I've started teaching a course in organic compounds and soil and plant environments, which means that I've learned a lot about lignin lately that I shouldn't have known before.
Thanks. I'm Shami. I'm from the Department of Agronomy, Kansas State University. I'm a PhD student, and I'm also attached to University of Peravinda in Sri Lanka. I have a faculty scholarship there, so I'm in on a study, and I'm reading my PhD here. I'm more concentrated to do my research work here. I'm working with urban soil.
Hello, everyone. Actually, I'm from Kansas State University. I'm a visiting scholar. My hometown is China. My major is plant nutrition. The course I teach is plant nutrition and fertilizer. My interest is how to increase the fertilizer efficiency in soil. Thank you very much.
My name is Mandy Leash. I'm with North Carolina State University, and I am a PhD student, and I actually work K-12 education and development stuff, and I'm really good at using kids' toys, including Legos, Playmobil, Kinect, erector sets, and all that stuff, and as well as theater, music, and drama to get kids to understand soil science from a perspective that's way more fun than some of the other stuff that they're trying to teach.
Thanks, Mandy. That's a lot of what we all learned from our friends.
Hello, everyone.
My name is
Susan Cunningham from Purdue University. My appointment is basically in crop physiology as a researcher. However, besides working in a lab with my students, teaching them aspects of lab analysis, my main focus of teaching is the same as my neighbor here to my right is K-12 education, which I've been doing since, almost 22 years as such. And basically, if you want to teach kids enzymes, use jigsaw puzzles and Legos. They'll learn a lot quicker.
My name is Yvonne Molly, professor at the University of Manitoba in Topic Systems and Agronomy. I'm tasked with teaching undergraduate, graduate, diploma, and doing field extension during the summertime. It's my first year of teaching. I'm a first year professor. So I feel like I'm finding out what I do know and I don't know about teaching. So it feels very kind of me.
I'm Tom Stillwell, professor at Wilmington College. You know Wilmington. What's that other ag school in Ohio? I teach mainly crops courses and computers. And I'd say my best success has been using competition in the classroom.
I'm a doctor student at the University of California, and I'm learning a lot about
science and social activity courses. And the most recent exciting thing that I've learned is metacognition, thinking about thinking. And I have explicitly integrated those things in my class in the last 2 years.
And it's wonderful to learn.
My name is Colby Warburg. I'm a doctoral student at North Carolina State University, Department of Programs. And in the past, I've taught freshman and sophomore level digital soils laboratory sections. And this spring, I'll be teaching a lab and field section for soil classification. And something I've learned recently is a graduate student professional development workshop for the Myers Briggs test. And I learned more about
it.
But I'm an extreme extrovert, and so I learn more about how to bring in introverts into conversations so they don't overpower the conversation.
I'm Steve Fail, professor of agronomy at Iowa State. I teach an undergraduate course in network issues and capstone reports in our national program this semester. Current issues in the ground. I guess recently, over the past year or so, what I've learned is how to really enjoy teaching. Thanks so much to Chance Hill.
I'm Derek Hunt, doctoral student at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I help with the discussion section, Intro to Agriculture Natural Resources. We focus on biodiversity losses, climate change, and this kind of typical agriculture. I'm also working with the Biomedical Regional Climate Center at UNL to on a climate change education project where we'll go out mainly rural areas in Nebraska and producers and capable educators on climate variability and climate change. Recently, I learned how little I still know about solar wise training apples, rates, and ratio in the climate study.
Tom Pfeiffer, University of Kentucky. I do undergraduate teaching. Friday, I learned that students didn't verify there's more sugar in the chocolate milk in the high school cafeteria than in the classroom.
Okay. Thank you. I'm
Mary Wiedenhaft. I'm from Iowa State University. I teach undergraduate and graduate students in crop and soil management and sustainable agriculture. And the thing that I just learned last night is that there are 5 Air Force bases in San Antonio and Pasadena.
John Vines from the Fort Knox University, Department of Technical Engineering, fourth grader. I'm also associate dean of academic programs at my college there. Regarding teaching, I'm teaching at graduate level course at the Western Park of undergraduate course. What I've learned recently, at least within the last couple of years, is that history course students power comes to much.
My name is Trevor Wallace. I work in Alberta Agriculture, which is a part of agriculture. I do a lot of extension one-on-one with farmers, producers, industry agronomists, a little bit of university guest lecturer roles right now. I'm currently developing a course for one of the
questions that are
David Holzhauser, Virginia Tech, extension agronomist. I've developed agronomic programs and educational opportunities to increase production. I focus primarily on soybean and soybean cropping systems. I recently learned that nothing substitutes face-to-face contact.
My name is Adam Howard. I'm at Oklahoma State University. I'm a master's student. Teaching in a solar cleaning lab and learned that learning how to become more comfortable with the lawn
crop.
I'll stand up. My name is Steve Teen, like 13, 14. Always have to get that out. I teach soils at Kansas State University for the last 41 years. And I also teach a graduate course on principles of teaching and learning, so that when our grad students move on, they know a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. And probably the most important thing I've learned in that course, and what I see and relearn a lot, is that if you want to get people to learn something, it has to meet two criteria, and that is, it has to make sense to them. It has to have meaning for them. And if your work does that, it's easy.
Thank you. For big town.
Yes.
Exactly, I'm not dealing with teaching, but students from university come and stays with us for 6 months for the dissertation work. And what I learned recently is delegate. I don't want to give everything A to Z of a protocol. If I ask them to explore and come out with a good solution, that really works.
And I'm Jan Thompson. I'm also at Iowa State University, and I'm associated with the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management there. And I've worked with the folks in Project LEARN for 15 years now. But my official role as a faculty member, I teach forest biology and urban forestry. I recently learned a new software program, but I had a couple crash burn.
Thanks, Jan. And we're back here.
Okay, I'm Mary Cavan. I'm in microbial ecology and the Tropical Environmental Science Arkansas. I teach from freshmen through graduate students. I work with our undergrad club, and I work with faculty and
knocking you down.
Oh, yes.
Hi, I'm Lisa Wood. I'm also at the University of Arkansas. But after a 22-year career at a facility of soil scientists, I'm now a PhD student in college education, working on a degree in science education. And my interest is in informal education, no child left inside, neighborhood, connecting the children back with nature and getting them away from it.
My name is Gordon Johnson. I'm an extension specialist with the Department of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Delaware. And what I'm really good at is bringing humor and fun into educational experience.
And again, I'm talking about I'm Ann Elmore, Roger's wife, and I teach piano at the Junior College in Boone, Iowa. And something I've learned this year, my son just taught me last week that you can make the rolls from scratch at 9 minutes.
Cool. Hi, I'm Roger Elmore, extension agronomist for Iowa State, and I'm teaching for the first time. So I came out of the blocks a little bit slow. Midterms were Friday. At 22 meals out, but the students probably got the rest. I'm at the 50-meter line, and my coach is at the sidelines, first Jan, saying, just relax,
Keep
your head up.
thank you. And a couple of folks came in since we started. They would like to introduce themselves and tell where they're from. And how they're
connected
with helping others learn. I appreciate it.
Ray Weil, the University of Maryland, Columbia University Earth Institute, various countries in Africa, et cetera. And I like to teach everybody from freshmen in college to aging farmers in Africa.
Great.
Thanks,
Ray. Jim, after you,
we have 30 copies of handouts. So if you're an Iowa Stater, please pass on the handout. And then if you are seated with somebody else from your institution, if you take one for your institution, we'll try to get more made, but we didn't anticipate quite the formal participation. So but close to enough, but not quite.
But it's wonderful, and I can always send an electronic copy too. Right now, we're going to take time out and take your learner hat off and put your hat on as those who develop learning. I really believe that a go-round, using the go-round, is one of the most effective strategies that I use. It has many, many purposes. One thing we know about interaction, research is very clear that the sooner a person speaks within a group, the more likely they'll speak later on and the more they'll say. So the opening go-round, one of the purposes of the opening go-round is simply to do that ice-breaking kind of thing to get folks ready to interact with others. And I really need to be able to call you by name, so if I come around and try to see your name tag, this is what you want to look at. We talked about the Myers-Briggs and the extroverted thinking and the introverted thinking. For the go-around, for those folks who have a tendency to be more of an introverted thinker and they don't like to open up and interact, it is a good starting point, but you have to be really, really careful that the first time you use the opening go-around is non-threatening. When I work with undergrad, well, with all my students, I always use an opening go-around. Usually for the undergrad, the opening go-around the first day is tell me your name, where you went to high school, and your major. And if you haven't decided yet, that's okay because most of you will probably change. That's very non-threatening. It's something no one should be able to challenge them. As you can tell, a go-round can take quite a bit of time. For me, I always go back to purpose. What's my purpose? What's my purpose? What's my purpose? One of my purposes today is to get a lot of interaction in here. Now, Roger did forewarn me that that might not be a problem. That you folks probably like to talk. But I still find this to be a very powerful strategy. Especially with my undergraduates, I try to attend really carefully to the suggestions that I put down there. And I use the go-around for lots of purposes. In addition to the icebreaker kind of activity this morning, one of my purposes was to find out more about each of you. To find out a little bit about your background in teaching and learning, and also to know what kinds of challenges you might have. As you look through what I've written down there about the opening go around, what questions do you have? Or possibly experiences? Good chance a lot of you are used to.
I find that asking students to give some kind of example of their most exciting activity for the summer as a place that it gets into more of their personal interests and makes it easier to connect with them than just high school and major.
And that's a great idea. As Bernie indicated, something that I think is very, very important in helping others learn is to get to know a little bit more about them. And that's what he has just said by having them share their most exciting experience from the summer. To know a little bit. It also, for me, I want my learners to start making connections with one another. So, go ahead.
No, you keep finishing.
Well, just in addition to that, I already told you, name tags are really important for me. In my class, with even faculty groups with which I work, I've got bright colored index cards that they have to write their name in the center, the name they prefer to be called by, large enough so that I can see across the room, and they have to wear those. I make them brightly colored to give them something to complain about. Because typically, a lot of them don't like to wear the name tags. Knowing their name is really important to me. As I try to develop a community of learners within the group, they need to be able to address each other by name too. So that's something I feel strong about. Now, thank you.
In response to Burns' thing, when working with K through 12, those kind of questions for a high schooler is about ground zero, or you're about 10 feet under, and you're digging a hole for yourself real quick. It depends on your audience.
It depends on your audience, absolutely. And one of the things that I was going to say after the opening go around, it's so refreshing for me to have folks in here charged with helping elementary through senior citizens, not seniors in high school, learn. Because what we know about learning, the foundational principles are the same. The challenge is to be able to transfer some of those principles to our own world. And you're absolutely right. When you're working with the lower up, actually knowing your audience is the best advice. Because you have to plan that opening, and I use closing go around too, so that you get the kind of information you want. Yes.
Yeah. Historically, extension education started with Joe. To break the ice. I can't do that. I'm not as good as you are in that. But in a go-around where you want to break the ice, do you have any ideas how to do that if your audience is 200 growers?
I do. Maybe I should go to Roger.
I want to hear
about it. Okay. My answer would be, or even in a lecture of 500 students, and that folks I would say they have that challenge, it would be something like, and you know, if we'd had 200 people in here today, I probably would have said, let's have these two tables going together and do the opening go around. Let's have these two. And then I would wander around and listen that way. So what I would do is, number one, if I thought it important, and if an opening go around is going to meet my purpose, which I believe an extension meeting could,
then I would do that. Everything that I have experienced today and we talked about, I want to be very clear. Number one, know your purpose. And will what we do or what we have experienced today help you meet that purpose? And so maybe in a large extension meeting, what would be the purpose?
I still think it does, because normally if it's you're an educator and you have 200 guys looking at you, there's barriers. You have to break that barrier down. You have to, there's a tension field there, invariably. I know them all by face, but I don't know them all by first name, like you're trying to, or what I could try to do when I teach. But you still have that force field there, use a Darth Vader. You have to break that. How do you do that? I can't, you know, we can't all have a big group party.
Right. Again, I would just try to put them in a small group. I would just say, what's your name? Well, Roger. Well, yeah, I used that with larger groups, you know, maybe up to 100, but you really have to keep it short and sweet. But it does really change the dynamics of the extension. You know, one difference I keep
asking Jen about, all right, this goes to the classroom. You see 150 people one time a year, and tomorrow you're at a different venue, and there's a different 100 people in front of you. Do these things work or not? It does break your nose. If you have a group that size, then you have to either make it short or divide into small groups, like you said.
Quick question. I understand the reason for getting people to communicate back. Does it you get some of your goals of getting them to answer questions, but when the parent just gets large groups?
Yeah,
showing of hands, if you have several questions for the people, your hands are supposed to speak to the others, would that still obtain some of the
purpose? What's your purpose?
The basic purpose would be a better understanding of who's in the room and what they're doing. How many acres do you farm? How many guys have feet? How many guys have pork? Those kind of questions, it always gives you as a presenter or a teacher an idea of the crowd that you're speaking to, so you can tailor the presentation. It's really helpful for subsequent people. It also gives the people in the room the opportunity to see, these questions also be tailored to issues. I mean, how many people have issues with X, Y, or Z? Give you a perspective that, you know, you're not the only one in the room with that issue when other people put it up.
Absolutely. I like that idea. I would still go personally with a small group coming in, his name, you know, name, and one other really quick thing. If I want the folks to interact with you on. If I don't want to, then if I just want that information and show hands, just want me to give a plain statement, sure.
What you talked about is DORA, and I realize I have used a modified version of it. And when I, not to the classroom, but when I go off campus and speak to a group, I'm only going to be there once. And what I do is ask for questions beforehand, and usually get them electronically. My young participants and organizers have to do this part, give feedback about them on there, not just their question, but their background, why are they asking this question, and so on. And then that really develops my talk. And then one by one, I'm doing a go-around because I talk about their question, their reason, and by the time you're done, you're probably going.
And again, depending on purpose, that's exactly a very effective and whether or not you want the interaction
to take play
on, and how many topics they have to be able to address.
Well, it generates interaction because somebody else might have that problem too. And we ask that during the talk.
It absolutely does. My experience has been there are a lot of folks, however, who would choose to sit back and not say anything and just listen. And I'm probably talking more about experience than graduates, even graduate students. I had the opportunity at Iowa State to work with leadership development with high school students. Those are students who have a National Science Foundation scholarship, a very nice one. their workers' information insurance and going into federal government to help protect our infrastructure, basically. And they're experts in computer science, computer engineering. They have to take 4 semesters of leadership development. And I have the honor and pleasure of working with them for 3 semesters. The first semester, however, isn't always pleasurable. These students are self-proclaimed computer nerds. They would be much better than look at a computer than interact with others. And just this past year, after one semester, or 1 year, then having an internship in federal government, a young man came back and said how glad he was that I had forced him to interact during class. And for him, one of the most important things were the go-rounds, because it forced him, he's a very, very, very introverted thinker, to have to organize his thoughts and put his thoughts out. And he realized during his internship how valuable that was, because he never would have stood up and put his thinking out on the table like they'd done before. So for me, it's really, really important to get everyone engaged. The go-around doesn't ensure that. Nothing can do that. But it increases the likelihood that every individual will be at least engaged in something, some kind of involvement. Right now, we're going to make a shift. And the shift is to the NFS Example Project Learn. Roger, did you want to know about this? Regardless, since we didn't let you know about the entrance exam, every faculty member with whom I've ever worked, every extension member with whom I've worked, every graduate and every undergraduate student has had to take the entrance exam before we go any further. Since Roger didn't let you know, Jan is going to help us a review of it. The entrance exam is made up, Roger, and I'm going to ask you to help me with this when we get ready. Yes, we do. Okay, entrance exam has 3 parts to it. In each part, you're going to have 6 word puzzles that you have to solve. We call them wordles. On the exam paper that, oh, don't look, leave that exam card upside down. Don't look at the page yet. Probably just help you hand them out. The letters are going to be arranged in a certain way that will remind you of a common phrase. For example, Jan is putting 1 word puzzle up here. What common phrase might that remind you of? Anybody?
Thumbs up.
Oh, good. Thumbs up. Yes. Very good. Let's try another one. Don't look at the papers, the test papers that Roger's handing out yet.
Cross-reference.
Oh. Yes, cross-reference. They don't need practice. Roger, no wonder you didn't tell them. They don't need practice.
Didn't they tell you that?
You did tell me that. I should learn to trust you. Yes, okay. So, you've got the idea. Don't look at the papers yet. Because this is a science test. There are 6 word puzzles that we have to solve. And I don't want to know what your neighbor or someone sitting close to you thinks is the correct answer. I want to know what you think the answer is. In other words, no looking at anybody else. And that's really important because we're going to grade this according to whoever gets the most right. Whoever gets the most right can get A. Next most right can get B. And so on. You have 6 word puzzles. You will have 3 minutes to complete the word puzzles. Does everyone have? Okay. Well, I did have 50 of those. So okay, you've got 3 minutes. Any questions? Go.
Thank you.
30 seconds are gone. It's on your own paper. Time's half up.
Six word puzzles.
Looking to see who's the best at solving word puzzles. So if you're irritated right now,
I'm doing what I plan to do. Okay, so we've got the shady deal on the upper left, even though some of you don't like that. Underneath that, what common phrase?
Go the distance.
Go the distance is interesting, however, that's wrong.
Go the great length.
Go to any length. Go to any length. That arrow there was going to any of those. Go to any length. The lower left.
Slide into second.
Yes. Sliding into second. How about the upper right?
High noon.
High noon? How about the one, oh, this is a tough one. Underneath high noon.
High chair.
What?
High chair.
High chair is very interesting, very close, but not right.
High chair.
This is an overstep? Have you taken this before?
No, I just read it.
Okay, he just said it wordles. Overstep chair. What was that?
No, it's an overstuffed chair. Okay.
Overstuffed chairs, yes. Now, lower right.
Middle school.
Okay. Anyone get all six right? How about five? There we go. There's our A. Right here. Our A is the A.
Hey, we don't break.
This is the structure that way. How many got four right? Did you get four or five right? That way. You got five. Four? There we go. There's a B. And we have room for improvement. Right now, however, flip that piece of paper over if you would. Please. Think about your own thinking now. Engage in that metacognition. And I want you to try to get in touch with what you were thinking, what reaction you were having from the time I said there's going to be a test. And then I gave very little review or even to know what you were supposed to do. And then I tried to stomp around and get in your space. You got obnoxious all the time. Then we went over the answers, and I wouldn't accept anything else. Write down what you were thinking, how you were reacting. Somebody already started calling me that. That's okay. Wait. Because I think it's important as we confront our beliefs about taking on. So, write it down. Be honest. I truly have done this with hundreds of adults and students. I think I've heard it all. The important thing is for you to be honest with yourself here. I'll be quiet now and let you think and write. Second part of the exam. We'll come back to it when we talk about it. First of all, however, we're going to do the exam in the center of the table, but it should have the second. Bart, please keep the papers down, don't look at them yet. Because once again, the second part of the exam is going to be timed. Again, you'll have 3 minutes. And you, once again, have 6 word puzzles, or you actually solve those word puzzles. I'm going to change one thing this time. Instead of being assessed by the person who gets the most right, we're going to set the criteria. However, I'm going to keep the bar kind of high. So we're going to say if you get 5 or 6 right, you get an A, 4 right for B, 3 right for C. Working on your own, 6 word puzzle, you've got 3 minutes. Questions? Go.
Yeah. only thing that was different this time, really, were the criteria. I set what was expected for A, B, and C. Still had 3 minutes working individually. Right now, what you're thinking, what your reactions were. You'll get a chance to see. Third part of the exam, bait down at your table. That's not if everyone has one. Don't turn them over just yet. This time I'm going to structure it a little bit differently. You're going to have 30 seconds to work on your own. And then at the end of 30 seconds, I'm going to say go, and that's the sign for you to go ahead and work with the people with whom you're sitting at the table. Talk about it, share ideas, and so on. We're going to aim for a total of 3 minutes. We'll see how long it takes. We're going to keep the criteria the same this time. Get there 5 or 6, right, for me, 4 for me, and so on. Before I say, go ahead and start working this time, what questions do you have? And if you had the answer, you'd be prepared to be more successful on this part of the exam.
Is the whole table going to be added? Just the people who do the work.
That's a good question. For the A, you have to have the answer written on the sheet. And you have to be able to explain that answer. So just writing down something here will not get you. What other questions do you have?
Have we seen any of this before?
Pardon me?
Have we seen any of this before?
I'm not sure what that means.
The content of this third part.
You've seen.
Was it in the notes?
Or if you had done the reading.
You've had practice with the kind of thinking required for this part of the exam.
The TA would have sent us the study guide.
What other questions do you have? If you had the answer, you'd feel more prepared to be successful on this part of the exam.
So could we go to different tables to ask you? Can we move around?
Why? You want to go over there and work with Craig? That's
self-sufficient.
Yes. That's a good question. However, to save time this morning, I'm going to ask you to say that first. take your learner hat off, put your facilitator learning hat on. How many of you heard me ask during the first or second part of the exam if you had any questions? Did I ask? Yeah, in the first or second? How many of you do believe that I did ask? You heard me? What? What's wrong with the rest of you? Why did you hear me? Suzanne heard me. Why did Suzanne write the rest of her?
I think as soon as you said test, they just said, okay, here we go again.
Well, and the other thing is you went right to your time.
And you went, you basically started. Yeah. I mean, it said, and it'll be starting in 3 minutes, and then you just went on your 30-second loop.
Right. No problem. It was definitely intentional. At the end of each of the first two parts, when I gave instructions, I said, any questions? Good. Go. And I'm so glad nobody jumped in with questions. What else was different that third time? Somebody already talked about the cost. But what else was different that third time when I asked if you had any questions?
You waited.
I waited.
You actually waited. You asked it again.
I was actually counting. And typically, I have to get to 8 or 9 before that first question is asked.
Your question was, what information do you need to be successful as opposed to, any questions?
Yes. The question I asked is very different. And if you want learners to think, you have to honor the time that you're required to think. The second time I said, the first two times, I didn't want to take time for questions. I didn't want anybody to ask the question. And we pretty much have our learners trained when we say, any questions? You know, we're packing up and ready to go. We're ready to move on to something else. And our learners know that, so it's kind of a conditioned response that any questions, oh, we're done. The question I asked was, what questions do you have? That if you had the answer, you'd be more prepared to be successful. In my mind, that question sends a very different kind of message than any questions. What's different about the message then?
Personalizes.
It personalizes it. What do you mean by that?
Well, what is it that I need to know in order to solve the problem or move ahead?
That's really neat. I had never thought about that. But it can be very much personalized. Asking each individual learner, what do you need? I care about your learning. What do you need in order to be successful? Yes. What else does the way I phrase that question do?
With respect to your question, if you had come at each table and asked, did you have any question as opposed to being there and around, and I would have to raise my hand, it's a threatening environment. Question, would it be more successful, I think, to get questions from each table?
Absolutely, it would. And it would take a lot more time. Again, I have to keep focused on my purpose today and how to best meet that purpose. But absolutely, once you set the atmosphere in the classroom, and Jan and I did do that and go around to different tables, but for some students, it's very intimidating to ask that question, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. What else?
Well, this might be part of what Vern was saying, but it seemed more like the way you did it the first time after your instructions of the process, that any questions may mean, are there questions about the process of what you're about to do, and not, are there questions about the information you may need to know within the process?
Yes, good point. Good distinction. Not so intentional on my purpose, but that is a good thing about my process and content.
Well, you also, and we're sort of addressing that, but it shows that you care if we learn versus I'm just here to test you. And I don't really care if you learned it or not. I'm going to grade you and I'm going to give you that grade, but did you learn? So how can I help make sure that I've learned?
Right. And that was definitely one of my purposes there. And I think in addition to that, what questions do you have? Invite questions. I mean, I expect questions. Any questions means we're done. Don't bother me. But what questions do you have means I expect to have questions. Now, what about the wait time? Go ahead.
When I do the formal classroom teaching, I basically go back, not at the end of the lecture saying, you have any questions? I come back first time, and then at the beginning of the next lecture, say, any questions? Mm-hmm. Is that still a conditioned response? If I just stated as, you know, any questions on last week's lecture?
So much of it depends on the individual situation and how
well
your students know you. It might be interesting for you to try changing it. I don't know what kind of response you do get, but...
Well, these are seniors, they're undergraduate seniors, so they're mostly dead in the world.
You might consider changing it. Because what that does, when, and I saw it on your faces when I said, what questions do you have? If you had the answer, you'd be prepared to be more successful. I saw a lot of you thinking, oh, there were the furrowed brows. Oh, that's different. What she did say? Oh, she wants to know what I need to know. Thinking takes time. If you want your students or your learners to think, you have to honor the time it takes. So it takes time to recognize, oh, that was different. Oh, is there something that I would like to ask? Then they have to think, what do I already know? What is it I would like to know? Then it takes a little bit of time to formulate that question in their mind. And then for some of your learners, it takes time to work up the courage to ask that question. So when I ask the question, what questions do you have? And I answer you because I'd be more successful. I was literally counting. And I was going to go to 12. It typically takes 10 to 12 seconds to go through the process I just described. Then, once that first question has come out, usually it takes less time for the next one. And again, you want to engage the learners in the game. You have to give them that time. So what happens when they start asking questions like, what are the answers? Well, you just have to be prepared for that. You know, my response might be, actually I'd be a little bit unethical for me to give the answers because I'm concerned about your thinking. And if I were to give you the answers, you wouldn't have that opportunity to think, so I'm not going to give But I rarely have to do anything like that. My experience has been that if you help learners understand why you do what you're doing, and they know that you care about their learning, they are going to be much more receptive to doing something different. And so typically, the very first time, well, I do this actual Wordles activity with my students the first day of class. And I explain to them why I do what I do. And so typically, they'll count with me. You know, the work you're trying to put the ideas through. And they understand the process and the purpose. Yeah.
Do you do it in the same way you did this one? First, second, third? Or do you do it at the start of the explanation? And you do those testings?
Well, I do it with my undergrad. I do it the same way I'm doing with the folks.
Get the same response?
My answer, yeah. I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
No, well, just the idea of this table, two people could have cared less about it. These two didn't understand, and I don't know about the third section.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, I just, similar responses around the table.
Yes, and that is, with every group I've ever worked with, it's very, very similar. Remember, I took a time out here, and we're not finished with the activity yet.
Yeah, I see that. There's another one to go.
Yeah, we go. And it's not the doing in the process of learning, mind. Well, research shows you're not doing the process of learning, it's the thinking about doing the process of learning. We're not even done with the doing yet, now we're going to think about the doing. So we might come back to that. What other questions do you have inviting your learners to think by the way you ask the question or about the amount of weight.
No, I'll wait until, I already made a very caustic remark about my undergraduate speech. One of the challenges that I have, and with this question too, let me ask, well, you know, the unanswerable thing, what's going to be on the exam? I'm going to give you that answer. I'm trying to give a caution environment that they're deep thinking. And this is a more existential question. One of the challenges that I've had in teaching over the years, my frustration, I grew up in the Netherlands. A very different learning environment. Here, at least in the institution I teach, there's so much what I would call a buyer's market for learning. They're being catered to the T. They're never been challenged. You know, oh, for you, I'll give you an A simply for showing up. And I'm the first class to encounter with that doesn't get the A. The tuition bought them the F. They have to earn the A. And it blows their mind. And so I'm considered to be an absolute, excuse my French, hard ass. Where I think I'm trying to do all these things already. How do you change that perception? It's a much more existential question, so I'll leave it like
this. Slowly over time. Is the only thing. Because we all tend to teach the way we were taught. And so we experience something that may be challenges, both of them. And my experience has been that even with that, not only have I had the opportunity to work with faculty and staff at post-secondary university, I also, my background is in the K-12 world. I got 9th grade plans for 20 years. I did a lot of training and cooperative learning with K-12 teachers. And the answer to your question, all of us have our own paradigm of teaching learning what I teach. And even if faculty change their paradigm, try to do things differently, students are still coming in with their own. I've already lost where I was going with this. How do you change to get students to change that their perception or their different opinion?
Because I have, my oldest ones are in 9th grade. And I see it there happening. It's there, it's good. And somewhere between 9th grade, which is the level that I've seen at this point, and by the time they become seniors in college, something went awfully wrong.
Which way you're thinking now?
Yeah.
And that's sad. And it's not totally their fault. It's a whole nother, day worth of conversation.
In response to your situation, I've been there too, called those names. But these students are also reasonable. They like to take the path of least resistance, but they're reasonable. And so I found if I tell them why I'm doing a process, then they follow along. So you have to teach them the process as well as the content.
And I did that. And I tried to. I only get the recognition of it 5 years after they.
That's the way it works.
Just accept it.
And look, you know, again, go back to your purpose. And I know we have to live with certain things. Is your purpose to get good feedback, or is your purpose to make a difference in life of each individual we touch? And to prepare the professionals of the future that we need to be good neighbors. You know, and that's, yeah, we have to examine that. But it does go back, it goes back to, if we help the learners, if we honor the learners, and they're thinking, help them understand why we do what we do, they're more likely to engage. And students really do like to think. I would agree we have trained the thinking out of them for different reasons, but they do like to think. And they will realize the power that they have to manage and control their own growth and development. And that's our goal. Okay.
Yeah, I find that even though I am the same name that you heard,
I give them the reason we were doing this, because I had to do it. Okay, some old guy walked in the office and says, hey, you've been to college. Okay, smarty pants, what is this? And they're going to be hit by that. And all of a sudden, hey, I'm going to be on a job. And do I really need to know this? Yeah, I had to know it. You're going to need to know it. You know, here's your first practice of knowing.
We're giving you practice knowing the kind of things that you're going to have to do the rest of your life. We're giving them that practice in the safety line. Okay, please go ahead and pass back on. Going back to the third party manager, Sam. 30 seconds on their own. I say go. That includes work with others at your table. Go ahead and start.
I have to fight through this.
So, you know, and you know,
Okay, time out. Whether you're finished or not, we set my purpose.
I could believe that.
And time is such a precious commodity.
If you looked at them, it all sounded like wishes, but then when you looked at it carefully, only one was spelled correctly.
And
it's underlined. So, therefore.
That was another clue, wasn't it? However, I want to hear what you had.
Yes, I suggested that it should be heart wishes, because the three words, if you look at them, they look like heart. If you just try to draw
a heart. He had drawn a heart around. I thought that was cool. Never.
Yeah.
are also tools that you can
I'll post this stuff. I do online.
Okay.
Mainly online stuff and a lot of what she talks about. This kind of but I do online as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have the plant and soil science e-library.
Okay.
It's a repository of the science.
And I guess it has to.
But at some point, you know, the long range of the society is the repository for our national society. So you have an educational component and resource for teachers.
Yeah.
Why are we remembering here when there are ways that we can capture some of the content, but also begin dialogue, we continue this dialogue ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a presentation the dynamics, so you might want to stop by and look at it and see what, you know, how that might be.
I'm just looking at your name to make sure.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it's the past of it's been on the works for the past.
Okay.
So,
now, since a lot of your repository is like modules, self-learning modules?
They can be self-learned from the learning modules that are resource creators. So,
Yeah.
online.
Yeah.
They already take it out now.
Yeah. Those are nice. Instead of having the hard copy, having it online.
Right.
But you know, you have to be intentional and creative activity that allows you to go back to those that I think is conventional materials that you have ended up here.
Yes.
And then I try to get it.
Right.
So, but.
Yeah, there's something about having that dynamic element,
yeah.
Of having people with
yeah.
People
yeah.
That I challenge.
Successful, less likely than it knows.
Okay, you know it's coming. Colby,
What is it you're thinking? Think about it. As I said earlier, it's not the doing that causes the learning. It's the thinking about the doing that causes the learning. That has been one of the biggest aha's for me in the last many years. For years, I taught ninth grade science. I had students doing labs. Weren't they learning? Not as much as they could have. If I had paid more attention to that, it's not the doing that causes the learning, it's the thinking about the doing. Because it was very possible for the student to do a lab, complete the lab report perfectly, and still not work for what they did. So now my challenge is always to develop those questions that will cause them to do the thinking, that will help them to do the learning. So back to the entrance exam. What were you thinking?
Why do we need a thinking entrance?
Why do we need a stinking entrance exam? What way to start? Again, I've been asked it, Gordon. When that thought popped in your mind, how did it impact your thinking?
You shut down.
I would invite you to think about, you don't say the same things as I did, but what kinds of ways do you structure interactions that might cause your learner to shut down? I trust another hand with what they wanted to say about.
Yeah, my first reaction would be, yeah, the first exam was that I was thinking, well, I guess she needs to sort of show how much we learn, so we have to pre-test and do the test at the end.
So you're thinking pre-test, post-test. Again, can you tell us how that impacted your thinking?
Well, I was thinking it was mostly something you sort of wanted to have to evaluate.
Yeah, for me, so
don't
I have to put too
much thinking into
it. Okay?
Challenge.
What really challenged you with that?
It's the challenge of just the game.
Okay, you like
the
team.
Yeah.
Okay, it wasn't the challenge of we're going to see who's back in here?
No, it was more right away that challenge of getting focused.
Okay, and so how did that impact your thinking?
What I tend to do with exams is
you were focused.
Yep.
That's what we want to do with our students. We want to focus their thinking. For some of them, they like that challenge. It wasn't necessary for the challenge, for his challenge to be the competitive way I structured the assessment. But I'll bet some, how many of you in here are kind of competitive? Okay. You probably looked around the room, yeah, I can beat you. You've got students like that. That's one thing I talk with students about. You need to know yourself. And you need to know if you need that competition, and if this is structured for you, structure yourself. Set your goals. But the majority of our students are not highly motivated by competition. They look around the room and say, I hope a few people. And some of them, that's what they've done to survive, is just good enough. So, the way we structure doesn't impact. Some other folks are going to tell us what they've written down in the back of that first sheet. Anything else you want to
add? Loss of control of the situation.
Okay, you felt no control over the place.
Well, up to that point, I felt like, you know, I was here because I wanted to be here, and that I would engage as much as I wanted to engage. But now, I finally got to the point where it's like, okay, I don't have control of my house, but what you're making me do.
How'd that impact your thinking?
Well, you jump into the focus mode like, oh, I'm going to have to get serious about this.
Surviving.
Yeah.
I don't want to be left out. Some of our students shut down in those situations. Suzanne?
I was like, good, this is a waste of time.
Absolutely. I didn't come here to play games.
That's right. So I was wondering when I was going to do what I was doing here, because it started out pretty cool and it went like, whoa.
Again, does that happen to any of the learners in your classes?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, that's something to think about. Yes. Panic. Here we've got one, and I saw this even in an adult group where you had to know it, but it wasn't going to matter. They're still in a panic. Talk to us about it.
Well, it's just a panic that, oh, I've got a test to do. And I've been, not this particular kind, but other kind of situations like this. And that's what happens to me. It's this panic. I've got to do a test. How am I going to perform? My whole brain shuts down, and I cannot focus. And I found as we went through these, the next one became a little easier because the answer became spontaneous. And then about the third one, I was more relaxed, more spontaneous, and things began to come. As soon as I started to think about them, I was awesome.
And what Kent just told us, described very well, that happens to a lot of our students, that panic or testing happened. And he described it very well. He said, I couldn't even think. What we know about the brain is that emotions impact the brain in a very strong way. Now, certain emotional engagement enhances learning, but when it's too great, it can really shut down. The cognitive part of the brain cannot function. Again, this is one of the reasons I do this with students, help them identify that about themselves, and then help them learn how to control that emotional reaction a little bit.
So the first place gets an A, second place gets B. That, I mean, you try to do your best, but then you know how many you got right, and you're like, nah, I'm not going to do well. I'm not going to be that A or B, so.
Yes, so again, what
did you think? Well, I still did as well as I could, but when there were three that I had blank, it was like, nah, I'm not getting that A or B.
I can't do it. I'm not good. Again, trying to put
this
back in the world of our
learners.
Yes.
I wrote down on the second one. The main difference that I perceived between the first and the second go around was that the second go around, and I had some practice. The first time I had no idea what I was supposed to do with those words. I'd never done a word before. I thought I was supposed to use some sort of quotation and phrase, some of the things like shady deal. My idea of what the answer would be. So I'm wondering, have you ever tried them in reverse order?
No.
And I suspect the main difference between the only difference I perceive between the first and second go around was that I haven't done it once. I kind of know what you're talking about. The first time I didn't know.
Right.
And I'm going to try it in reverse order, though, just as a scientific experiment.
It might be interesting, depending on purpose. And my purpose is really to have as much of a shock factor with that person as I can. Because I want us to remember what it's like to be in situations where someone else has planned the learning and what it can do as far as thinking. Because learning only happens when thinking occurs. Yes.
So what anxiety management do you teach this business?
I can't say I teach anxiety management. I have no training in psychology, but I simply, number one, ask them to, my first goal is to have them recognize what happens and understand then a little bit about what happens in the brain. As we go on through the semester, we do some work with the brain and learning and memory and how it impacts it. The very simple advice that I give them is you're the only one that can control your emotional reaction and you can control it. So I ask them to recognize during the next week when it happens. And it's then found it's definitely simple. Ask them to take deep breaths, maybe even close their eyes, and think about how well they've prepared. They've done everything they can to be prepared for the situation and to do their best. One of the big learning expectations that I have for my students is that they do a reflection journal, and then they think about their thinking reaction, and then they'll write about that, and then it does get easier. So that's the best I do with them. Any other thought or reaction or advice that you have?
No, it's just I have that experience too. I had it all the way through. I did all right, but it was a difficult thing. And when I took my last exam on the PhD, I said, that is the last exam I'm ever going to take in my life. I've never taken another course that requires an exam.
Absolutely. And we have a lot of students that, for some of them, just realizing that, oh, yeah, you feel that way too? Yeah, I feel that way. That helps too. And And certainly, if there are extreme cases, then, you know, we do have different areas on campus that can provide some of that. Let's go on, if you haven't already gone to the second part of the exam, is there something else?
No.
For the second part?
It's just along those lines, and I think, practice by, well, appreciate that. Practice makes perfect. My first going was, dang it, need more practice. Goes back to what you used to.
Okay, so for you, you were still challenged.
Yep.
You were still thinking, I'm going to get better at this, and we have a little bit of practice, and kind of thinking this, maybe I can do better. Okay. Anybody else? Second time, any other thoughts?
I ignored your pacing in your time part. I was just trying to focus on the past.
You didn't ignore the first time?
I didn't.
Good. Thank you for bringing us back to that. That's the point that I also wanted. Jan and I were trying to stomp around the room, but it's hard to stomp. And the purpose is just to have us all think about what kinds of things might we do unintentionally that distracts learners. And when I'm working with my students, I want them to realize
how easily distracted they are.
When you were distracted on that first one, what is this you're thinking?
I was whining, and I would say, she didn't give us any examples, so I stopped thinking and just stopped doing it.
Right, you stopped, yeah, you were not too happy that I didn't get more practice. You let me know that right away. What she doesn't make me realize, she really didn't need to verbally tell me that. I read the nonverbals. Again, it happens in your classes all the time, if you pay attention. And again, we need to think of anything else on the second?
What did you say?
I
was fearful of not knowing three.
You wanted to get that C at least. Okay, good. And something to think about, when you've got four, how many of you kind of let up and then, good enough, especially to do that. They just want to get that in your seat. They don't want to learn as much as they possibly can. Well, maybe your students all do. No? Okay. Anything else on the second exam?
Well, my peculiar mind, I said, this could be fun.
I love the optimism. Optimism is great.
I guess I was going to say the same thing earlier. Because you put that strict grading scale on there, I felt like, okay, they're obviously, there's a greater perception of how well I should be able to do on this, so it increased the pressure.
Yeah.
And then I didn't do very well the second time either. I didn't do very well either time. And at that point, I thought, okay, I don't really see the importance in being good at this, so I really don't care at this point, whatever this activity is.
And so you're thinking,
By the end of the second one, I'm like, I was pretty disengaged with this. I was like, I don't really care if I can solve these word things.
Again, and that really goes back to what we do with students. It goes back to, I think, Steve, and then we can go around. Did you talk about meaning?
Sense and meaning.
And sense for the learners. If we can help them make meaning, that's more than memorizing the definition. It's being able to put things in their own word and in their own world now, not in 4 years as professionals. So we can't help them make meaning, and if it doesn't make sense to them in their world, it's really hard for them to learn it. And that's a real challenge for us in our classrooms. Let's go on to the third example. This time, 30 seconds to work individually. Didn't have an opportunity to work with others. Anyone care to share with us
their
thinking on this one?
Steve? Well, we found nobody in this table got them all right individually, but together we got them all right. So group think gets you to the answer, but I'm not sure group think helps the individual learn that much.
Well said, and you have to be very, very careful. And in a 3-hour session, I'm not prepared, nor could I ever help you really explore the essence of what I call true cooperative learning, where we help students work together to enhance the learning of each individual on the team. And so the third example was structured collaboratively or cooperatively or giving a chance to interact with others and share thinking. But there are all kinds of issues, starting with the one that Mary brought up when we did the example of three. And so what you said, Steve, I hear you and you're right. And certainly we need to be cautious about that. Very, very, very simply put, my philosophy about having students work together, I believe that they learn together, but they still need to be assessed individually. And getting from here to there is incredibly complex. What are the thoughts about that third way of structuring interaction? Go here and then there.
What's going on? In the last opportunity, he allowed us to have multiple answers that were correct as long as we can describe the answer.
How did that impact your
thinking? Give them freedom to think.
It encouraged thinking, hopefully, didn't. And allowed more the diversity of thinking. Is that a priority? Yes, the right answer.
So, because I had to explain why I answered the way I did, it actually gave me confidence that, oh, I probably have the right answer, so that when you asked me to justify, I had already sort of put up this trial balloon. And in one of them, I was wrong. So I could have been wrong in front of you, but these guys kept me from going down the wrong path. So it gave me some confidence.
Yeah, and that safe environment to explore and not have to be right the first time, good, and you can see.
Well, I was just going to say, are you talking about the flexibility? Are you essentially finished and then it's fine? This is how much I have answers.
Oh,
so it sort of inspired the group to go further.
Oh, so instead of just being done, we're challenged to keep thinking whatever. That is cool. That is cool. And it goes back to students, learners who like to think. They like to be given that permission and that challenge. Anything else?
I just kept thinking, oh, this is it's still just pattern recognition. And so once somebody shows me the pattern, yeah, I can see it, but I'm not learning anything. It's just pattern recognition.
Right. So as far as the world and the different ways of solving the world. Absolutely. If my purpose today were to get you to be better at solving word puzzles, I would have failed. Because I did a lot of form modeling, allowing people to shout out the answers. What's wrong with that? When Jan put the thumbs up there, and we just let people shout out the answers, what's wrong with that?
They stop thinking.
Everybody else stops thinking. Again, if you expect your learners to think, you have to honor them.
Reminds me of a question I had earlier about the time it takes. You said you were prepared to go 10 to 12 seconds. So what happens when you get to 12, 15 seconds and it's still not working?
Well, I have
a pattern
to get implemented with this. In that specific example, I would have said, okay, I would have said what I was doing. In my classes, I've given that long, there are no questions, then I go on. But typically, it doesn't happen.
What do you do when you ask a question, you have one student on the ball, and he's answering before the rest of the class has had the time to think about it? How do you handle that?
I just absolutely ask him to wait. And I'm going to model for you here a very, very specific strategy you can do, but if that were happening, if it were Craig, I would not in front of the whole class, but maybe say, Craig, we had to give people a little bit more chance to think. Please do that. Or probably before I did that, I'd say, okay, you can ask a question, and before anybody says anything, I want you to write down your thoughts. And just ask them to do that. So there are a couple of tricks out there. Yes?
Related to timeline, too. I started doing group discussions, and some groups will discuss for very long. So I give them time. I tell them how much time I'm going to give them for a few. Some people can go really long. done in 2 minutes no matter what. Any suggestions on trying to, I want to give them that time to think, because some people are easy, and then when I see other people, I'm done.
A couple of quick things there, maybe interacting with that group and asking them some questions and challenging them more. Maybe having a challenge question that would cause them to go a little bit deeper with it. But that is definitely a challenge when you start to see more. Maybe I'd be glad to visit just a little bit more after our session. Right now, what I'd like to have you do is I want individually to have you write down the answer to this question. And it's a long question, I'll ask it one more. But considering that the wordles, we just spent an hour and a half on word puzzles. Considering that experience, what are the implications for you as you plan the learning for those with whom you're charged to help learn? In other words, so what? We just spent an hour and a half on something. So what? What are the implications for you as you plan the learning for those with whom you're charged to help learn? In other words, from your experience, from what you just experienced, what are a couple of critical things that you're going to remember, maybe not to do? Do or not to do as you plan on learning from others? Now, before I ask some folks to share their answer, I'd like to have you take a couple minutes at your table and work with just one or two people. Don't all five work together, just one or two people. Tell that person or the two people that you're working with what you wrote down. Listen to what they wrote down and see if you can maybe come up with a few more implications for planning learning. And then I'll give you probably about 5 minutes for that, and then I'll ask for some responses from the group. So go ahead and work with one of the
guests.
Thank you.
it was just a part of the short spot. And I was going to say, that's why.
Stomping around.
Okay.
So cognitive distraction is a watch for the distraction, whatever.
Or anything else that shut down.
Right. Will you tell me one thing you and your partners talked about back there?
Oh, yes. I thought about helping students think, because I think that the best way to develop people is to catch them doing something right. And especially for students, it's good to catch him thinking. If you find some student thinking, you have to praise him in front of his colleagues, as you did with me a few minutes ago.
That's cool. Thank you. You know, see how interesting it is, well, this is dependent. I didn't plan that when I was planning sessions. When you plan for learning, you never know what folks are going to learn. And then this is always what you want them to learn. But unless you read what they write or hear what they say, you don't know what they're thinking. And if you don't know what your learners are thinking, how are you going to guide your learning? Let's have... one more, yes.
I found that what you said was an aha moment for you. Could be for me, but I would love for you to email out the reference. You said the research shows that it's not the doing, it's thinking about the doing. That would, of course, totally revise the way we run hands-on and laboratory things. And that would be interesting. If there is a body of literature that shows that, I'd like to see the data.
I want to correct what I thought I said. I didn't think I said research shows that. I said the quote, it's not the doing that causes the learning, but thinking about the doing that causes the learning really has transformed what I do. So I think there's research. I don't have that. I know the quote came from David Perkins, who is in the K-12 world, and it's from an article by Robert Lehmanson, L-E-A-M-N-S-O-N, called Learning as Biological Brain Change.
There's somebody at Harvard that does it, or at MIT, that does some of what you just said in physics.
Oh, okay.
But that's also what Martha was saying about metacognition, too. And there's a large literature on metacognition.
A large, yes, absolutely, huge. Yeah, it is the thinking. It's the thinking. My undergrad students, if they hear me say that once, they've heard it 1,000 times by the end of the semester. Some of them in their journal or even now writing, it's the thinking, and putting a smiley face. Okay. We could go on for a couple hours talking about implications from each of you. However, my purpose really wasn't that as much as it was for you to experience what we believe is a deceptively simple strategy that will increase the likelihood that students are doing the kind of thing he wants to do. At each of your tables, Nancy passed out, it's a white copy that if you choose to use it, you can use it on Elmo or maybe Transparency. It's called the Turn to Your Partner. Those of you familiar with more of the educational literature, this actually comes from David Johnson Rogers from the University of Minnesota, Cooperative Learning. However, there are a lot of other cooperative sources, Slavin, those that might be Kagan, might be called Fair Share, that kind of thing. Turn to your partner. You just experienced it. Very structured strategy. First of all, the facilitator of the learning has to formulate the question. You will not always use quite as complex a question as I did to start with. What are the implications for you? Blah, blah, blah. However, you give them the question, then you ask them to individually formulate a response. When I did this early with students, I asked them, just like I did you, to write down your response. You don't know what students are thinking if you don't hear them or read what they write. And I'm over their shoulder looking at what they write the first few times we have a TTYP. Second step is to give them a partner ask them to share what they've written down with their partner, listen to their partner, and together reach toward a deeper understanding. We believe one of the most important things about this effectively simple strategy is that last part, holding them accountable for the kind of thinking you ask them to do by calling on them at random. Boy, that's one of the hardest things I found for faculties to call on students at random. Expect them to speak up. Yeah, after they've had the opportunity to talk real well with somebody, I think that they should be more comfortable with that. But there are ways to do that that will increase the chances that they're going to say something. As you experience this, when I hold you accountable by randomly calling on a few folks, do you remember what I did? I think Lisa was the first one that I asked. Lisa, do you remember how I asked you to answer the question?
Well, you asked that I would share something that the group discussed.
Yes. I said, Lisa, will you tell us one thing that you and your partners talked about? Did that cause any kind of reaction in you based on what I just said? Lisa, what are the implications?
It sort of leads to a shared response.
Right. Typically, with under 5 months, when I do that, the first response is, well, my partner said. And then after a week or two, it's, well, we said. And pretty soon, well, here's what I think. The TTYP is powerful, not only for increasing the likelihood that the students will be doing the kind of thinking you ask them to do, but also in building that safe environment where learners know that they're working together to learn, and that sometimes that's risky business. Sometimes you have to step out there and take a risk. That might not be right, but it's okay. If I'm wrong together. And then much of how you respond also indicates whether or not it is a safe atmosphere. Turn to your partner takes time. If you believe it might help your students meet some of the learning goals you have for them, I would recommend that the first time you do it, you go through step by step. Find them. Help them understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. That may take 10 or 15 minutes. However, if your question has been well planned, think about what else we know about learning. Learning requires repetition. On the average, learning something just simply for recall takes about 15 repetitions. So you mention it once in class, and then you have it on the text, and students don't know it. They probably didn't do the 16 repetitions on their own. However, look at how quickly you can get after more than one repetition. You talk about it, you ask them a question that engages them thinking about it. Then they have to tell their partner. They have to listen to their partner. We're up to 4 repetitions right there. Then if you randomly, together they reach toward a deeper understanding, that's really engaging in it in a different way. And you randomly call on 4 or 5 folks, you get up to 7 or 8 repetitions right there. Now, what we also know about learning is we can keep something in short term or work, no, something in working memory for about 24 hours. So those 7 repetitions, if they don't do anything else with it, probably won't do it. But you can come back to the next class and engage them in thinking about that again. And then they're going to get more of those repetitions. What questions do you have about deceptively simple strategy? Or experiences. Chances are many of you have already used this. Well, you opened it. He had his hand up before I asked a question.
How does Roger do that? Roger, when you do this in extension with 2-foot guys, there'll be once, like you said, the most of the time you see them once a year. You know, I struggle with that too. How do you get that environment to allow for that in that audience?
It really works pretty easy. The hardest part is when somebody's sitting by themselves. They're off, you know, sitting in a chair eating a donut and drinking their coffee. That's the hard part. The rest of it's pretty easy. If you ask a question that's pertinent to your topic, people are there usually for a purpose and they're willing to talk about it. So you break those barriers down and it works pretty, it gets pretty lively.
But you have to get that, you know, normally we do show up, PowerPoint goes up, there we go. That repetition of 15 times, that getting it beyond the working memory is what I'm, how do you get that with engagement? I can get, I've been around long enough, I can get engaged. But if you're thinking about it, how do you actually thinking about it? How do you create that environment in that very static 15 minutes?
And I'm going to answer this with a possibility, and I don't know if Roger has tried this or not, but a closing go around with the group instead of PPYP. The closing go around that has the kind of question that will ask them to think about their learning, what's the most important thing you learned today, what's something you're going to continue to think about. There are other ways of giving them a note card and having them write down one thing they learned. And I've gotten into a book.
I'm wondering if prior experience helps what sort of that, at least with a user experience setting, if they've been wrestling with an issue over time, 8 weeks, years, they've been asking those questions already, so if you're in a setting where they're primed to learn from each other, that might be two or three times they have gotten an answer.
Right. And you bring up another great point that we haven't talked about with learning, and that's prior knowledge. All learning is based on prior knowledge. And all of our learners come to every learning situation with prior knowledge. Some of it's misconception. And that's the tough one. And even if you work with it, you can pop them up. But that prior knowledge, the misconception, those are huge issues when you're helping others learn. What do you do about it? You develop a question that will reveal it, get it out in the open. You've got to know what you're learning, and you're going to help make it learn. What other questions?
On the extension side, the newest way to sort of pull back from the group is to start looking at the iPhone. And I'm wondering if anybody's had to deal with that directly.
You mean as a clicker?
No.
Oh, you mean losing people that are looking?
Losing people.
You mean like
pull out the phone and start looking at what's on the messages. Yeah. And that sort of disengages them from the discussion. Else, do you just take that head on and say, please don't use your iPhone, or you just work harder to try and get their attention?
You're talking extension.
Yes.
I'm not afraid of calling on somebody that seems not to be paying attention and saying, what do you think about the topic I just talked about?
Pretty good, Roger.
I do that in extension. I do it in the classroom, too.
In the classroom, yeah.
But I do that in extension often, especially if they're starting to, if that's disrupting other people's learning. I'm not shy. Well, I am shy. But I'm not shy about calling somebody out that is disrupting other people and distracting other people's learning.
And, Roger, is it fair to say that that's larger because you know your purpose and you're focused on your purpose?
Yeah.
You know, I think that helps.
I was going to say, if it's a grower looking at his phone, ask him if he has a market update for the rest of the group.
There you go.
It's a great way to call him out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have the same issue with students, so I don't think it's
totally need to grow it. And I formally wrote into my syllabus, you know, my approach and policy on technology use. I want to encourage some technology use, and I want to discourage the distracting technology use. I wonder, in the extension form, if we now have to break our policy forward and say, hey guys, for the next 15 minutes, we're going to focus on this topic. And I ask you to turn off your phone, you know, which seems ridiculous to ask grown-ups to do, but maybe it's necessary.
Yeah. And we're not going too far down the road, folks. Simply because I'm going to honor time for other Iowa State folks to show what they've been doing. We don't have much time left. That the heads up for Iowa State folks, you're on next. And Colby, you had
a question. I was just going to comment for you. So one thing that's resonated with me is a millennial generation. Like one of my first soul science classes, we were told that the average cost per credit hour of like in-time class is about $15. And as a student that was myself in college on student loans, that resonated with me. So what's more important, $15 or one text message?
Good way to help students. It all comes down to choice. Students make those choices. Another thing that I'm reminded of, I think in all learning situations, not only do we know our purpose and keep focused on that, I hope we all set high expectations for learners. And then we must hold them accountable for working to meet those expectations. And that's how I address the issues in my class, so the distractions, you know. Not a pretty transition, but here's, we've got about 20 minutes left. What I'd like to do is give Iowa State folks a chance to say a few words, and hopefully about 5 to 12 we'll start closing go around. It won't take too long. So that's where we're headed. And we didn't organize this. I'm really sorry. Roger, I'm going to ask you.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's a lot of things I've been learning here. And I'm at the 50-meter line from teaching the agronomy crop production class as well. But I've been in extension 37 years, so. One thing that I don't think we got into much here, but the Windows 2 that I've been using a lot, and it asks people to categorize what they're learning into 3 or 4 different categories, and one of those is the facts you're learning, and the questions that you might have about those facts, and then the ideas that come out of that learning process. And the 4th category is the emotions that came out of that process. And Jan helped me come up with a better word for farmers. You don't talk about emotions with farmers. So we talk about reactions. And it's amazing if you, at the end of a session, if you just simply say, okay, what kind of ideas came out of this talk today? What are you thinking about? And then I'll say, what reactions do you have to the content on plant populations? Really exciting topic. What kind of reactions do you have to this? And 9 times out of 10, the very first guy that starts wearing it in your seat, and I'll point to him, says it's an emotional response. I don't want to plant that many seeds. Seed companies are gouging me. I'll pass the mic to Mary sitting over here.
So I've been using this for quite some time, and one of the things that I thought was really important in the beginning was that our students, I teach a capstone class, so my students have had 4 years of college, and so by the time they get into my classroom, they are sort of conditioned. And they're conditioned not to answer questions. They think all questions that I'm asking are rhetorical. And they also have never been asked to answer the question. And I have a small classroom, so I really can ask them the question. So I think it's really important to do that. Go around the very first day, because it says to them, you're going to be talking. And I also want them to use each other's names instead of saying, well, he said, which he, I have a lot of he's in my class, which he said that. And so start using their first name so that there is this personal connection. And then also having them write down their answer before I ask them so that they have some confidence and that they could just read their answer, but at least they have a response. I think also I tell them that when you have a career, your boss is not going to give you all the information you need every day, and then you go out and do something, you're actually going to have to think about something on your own. And you're going to be asked questions by the farmer of things that you weren't prepared for. So some days I'm going to ask you questions that you're not prepared for, just so that you can start to get ready and start to learn how to answer spontaneously, which is the very thing that I had the hardest thing doing myself after I graduated. And so, and if you want me to tell you everything you need to know, then that's a micromanaging boss, and I don't think you want one. So start thinking.
Yeah. Over to Steve, Steve Bales.
Yeah. So I've been teaching a course junior senior level to a broad array of students, majors from all over campus. Use this approach that Jim is talking about today exclusively in this course. Have 50 students in the class, and I think one of the first things that's critical to do is and I think the opening go around helps do it, but is establish a safe environment. Lecture two, and they're very hesitant to come up of themselves unless you make it very clear that it's safe for them to express their opinions. I have a rubric actually that's in the syllabus that has things like everybody's opinion is valued, even how even maybe unpopular. And as a result, students pick up on that. And once we've established the safe environment, you talk to your partner, I think it helps that very, because it's rather than one person expressing their view or their answer, there's some security in two coming together. And I sometimes would expand that to small groups, no more than four usually. But one of the things you have to watch out for is that inevitably someone's going to dominate. And sometimes you'll get not the view of the group coming up and that accountability, but the view of the speaker. So I deliberately go back and pick on another person or the other person and say, do you agree with it? Do you have another idea? So you've got to be aware of that dynamic going on. But it really works. I think students are more ready to do this, you might think, even after they've had all these years of anti-thinking drilled into them. I think they're ready for it, they're thirsty for it, and I really hope you guys have a chance.
Thanks, Steve. Michael, talk.
I teach courses in soil and water chemistry and also kind of organic chemistry for agronomists. And I have been using some of the techniques that you talked about, especially the Trinity Department, in my classes. I don't do it every period. I try to do maybe one or two per week. No, maybe more than that. Maybe one a period, but in modified forms. The turn your partner approach has been, I think, very effective with my students because they enjoy the interaction with one another and the immediate application of an idea. One technique that I have been trying out recently is at the end of one class period, posing the question. Maybe it will be just a single question, or maybe it will be a short exercise. Ask them to come to class the next day with their answer ready, and then the first 5 minutes of class will be the turn to your partner, where they can work out with their colleague what their response is going to be when I do call on them randomly. So that has helped me save a little bit of time in the classroom. And time is, that's where I struggle with the kinds of techniques we're talking about here. You know, there's a body of material that I inherently want to cover in my courses that I think students need by the end of the semester, or I will have failed. And yet, I have to keep constantly reminding myself that it's not my covering the material that's important, it's whether the students have effectively learned the material at the end of the semester that's important. And that has required me to choose the topics of the course much more selectively. And there are things that we don't cover in my courses that it was sure covered when I took that course, you know, but I said, well, okay, it's more important for my students to learn something well than for me to cover it. So that's been my biggest struggle, I think, with some of these interactive and collaborative techniques. That said, I think it's been very effective for the students, and the students seem to respond well to it.
Thanks, Michael. And Janet Thompson.
I have been fortunate because I work in a department where there were a number of folks that took immediate interest in this when we were offered a workshop a number of years ago. So I've been working collectively with a group of 7 to 10 at various times faculty who really bought into doing this big time. And one of the things that we teach is a captive set of 6 courses where we have students at the sophomore level, and they're embedded in this set of courses, and all of the faculty have been exposed to this kind of pedagogy, and most of us use it on a regular basis. And one of the things that was mentioned earlier was being very transparent with the students from the very beginning about we're taking this different approach, and being very transparent with them about why we're taking this different approach, and that our focus is on their learning. And I heard somebody say earlier, you know, you hear back 5 years later when they finally get to the point of understanding the method to your madness. But we're very upfront. We tell them what the method to our madness is. And sure, they resist for a while because it gives them more responsibility in the classroom. And one of the other mantras besides it's the thinking, it's the thinking, it's the thinking that we have heard over and over again is, as faculty members, we have to persist longer than the students resist. So persist longer than they resist. And you know, it's totally fair to you know, take a time out where you need to and say, this is why I'm asking you to do this. So
thanks, Jeff. And back to you, Jeff.
Okay, thank you. At Iowa State, we have a faculty development program called Project One. LEARN stands for Learning Engagement Action / Resource Network. The resource network comes into play more so after the workshop. What we try to do is spend anywhere from 2 to 4 day workshops, 8 hours a day, where faculty are immersed in the kinds of things you folks have experienced this morning. In fact, you've experienced the first 2.5 hours of the workshop. We ask students to engage in different kinds of strategies we think might be effective for their learners. The workshop is a good start. And all the folks you just heard from have been in the workshop one time or another. Beyond the workshop, we offer bi-monthly meetings throughout the year, where every 2 weeks we meet for 2 hours to continue to talk about teaching and learning and facilitating learning. And that's where we notice the growth really happens. Because typically, if you go and try some of these things, they don't always work perfectly every time. So you come to a meeting, you talk about how bad it was, and I'll never try it again. But you hear somebody else say, well, man, I did this. You can't believe what my students did. And so we talk about that, and we continue to explore learning. So what you experienced this morning was just an introduction to begin thinking maybe a little bit differently about planning the learning for others. So that can refer to learning-centered classrooms. So really on purpose. What is it that we want our learners to know? And then how are we going to engage them in the kind of thinking we expect them to do? And how we form them. Bring closer to our time, or I guess I'll throw this out because I like to honor stop times. I would be glad to respond to any questions you might have that you want to stay after, or my email address that I will say is janw@iastate.edu. And so if I don't answer the questions they have today, I don't like that too. And I might not have the answer anyway, but I think it's within possibility. And I truly do love working with anyone who loves learning, and especially those who are concerned about the learning folks. We are going to close with the final go round. I'm going to model the final note that you might do it, so that it might not take quite so long. In 7 words or less, tell us something you learned, relearned, or will think more about after interaction today that will make a difference for those you plan to learn. So you might want to write it down first. In 7 words or less, tell us something you learned, relearned, or want to think more about related to climate. I debated whether to give you 3 words or 5 or 7. And one of the all-time bloopers that one of the groups was in one word or less. That was quite a challenge.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, 7 words or less. So I'm on here, right here, great.
Thinking about doing positive learning.
Thank you. We're going to say.
Spend more time thinking like a principal. Anticipate, accept, and judge.
Start a third ball and count to 50.
We're going to go, let's see, this time we're going to go around this way.
I like a purpose judge.
And everybody be loud enough so everybody can hear it.
Check your assumptions.
15 to 16 competition.
Put time into framing questions.
And rephrase the question.
Allow time to interact. Form some game to learn with questions. More student engagement and discussion.
Do not forget to explain the purpose.
How a student feels about getting it.
There's power. Engage with emotion and teach and interact.
Other than the physical.
Teach process as well as content.
Group planning activities.
Allow students ample time to formulate questions. It's easy to fall back. Sure, there is adequate time, but not.
Let's go way to the back table
with this. Cafeteria interactions were improved. This includes students all the dining they listen to.
Create environment to think unusual, not routine.
Try really big things.
Oh, I need more talking in class.
No audience work.
Give more opportunity for the students to understand things.
engage the learner.
Ask students to speak early on.
You have to know your audience background.
Know your purpose and honor the question.
Structure for learning depends on purpose. And mine is ask more than you have. Folks, I want to thank you. Coming on a Sunday morning, Aaron San Antonio, and some of the guests got here. I really appreciate your investment in time, and I appreciate how much you care, apparently care about the way